Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. I've had the pleasure over the last decade or so of thinking with Ray Sawatsky, thinking about religion and culture. I'm delighted to talk with him in this series of conversations on the ecclesia. He's an astute commentator on the entanglement between a number of political interests and evangelical church leaders. How have these entanglements shaped his generation's growing unease and distance from the churches that shaped their childhood? Ray has worked very effectively with a number of parachurch organizations, family charities, educational institutions, think tanks, all part of the broad evangelical world. Few have as rich a sense of the shape and reshaping of the evangelical traditions and their implications for both church and the larger culture. He explores the model of the evangelical church's international charitable work. In the last few years, he has been giving sober second thought to much of what he has been a partner in. Where is the other in the evangelical church? Why the fixation on the sexual life? Is charitable work also a process of manufacturing need and the latest chapter in colonialism? Have we created a charitable industrial complex? Are megachurches a kind of spiritual Walmart? How did this all unfold? And where does it lead? Welcome to our conversation. A number of years ago when I first met you, Ray, we talked a fair bit about your early experience in the Gospel Halls, one of the wings of the Plymouth Brethren movement. It was both troubling and certainly of interest to me to hear how you navigated that world and what you had come to through that, the Gospel Halls, the Brethren movement, has what I would call a pure church ecclesiology. Mm-hmm. It understands the church, as do the various wings of the Anabaptist movement, as a pure fraternity of believers. They're all on the same page. Mm-hmm. And being on the same page, or at least appearing to be on the same page, is absolutely essential to their own sense of their identity. And you have also worked for most of your life. Mm-hmm. You, of course, have been a history teacher. And frankly, I have seen you in the classroom. I've been there with you. And I know that you are, in many ways, a master teacher. Mm-hmm. I have appreciated seeing how you navigated that world with young people. Really remarkable work and the trips you took them to Europe and what have you. And you, of course, are also a volleyball coach. Mm-hmm. But most of your work has been with para-Christian organizations, largely charitable organizations, as well as, of course, your work at the think tank in Ottawa when you were a fair bit younger.
The years have passed quickly.
They sure have, haven't they? Mm-hmm. So you've worked in these various Christian organizations, raising money for a variety of charities, doing what certainly appears to be good work in various places around the world. And you have lived your Sabbath days within particular churches. You have more recently come to a place where you are rethinking both your relationship to the church, by which we mean those evangelical churches, and thinking about the church's relationship through these organizations to various forms of good work in the world. As you work through this rethinking of your relationship to the church, a number of things have surfaced for you. And some of that has been quite critical of what you have come to see as the, perhaps I could just call it the shadow of those churches. So let's begin there.
Sure.
What's unfolded for you in the last couple of years in your way of thinking about the church, and the church which you've always had, at least since I've known you, you've always had a perspective about the church, which both the churches that you've known, a perspective about them which wasn't with rose-colored glasses on. You know, you always had a capacity to be somewhat critical of them. But it seems to me that you've come to a somewhat new stage in your way of thinking about how they're held together, what their métier is, what their central concerns are. Where does that sit?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's so many entry points to that question, David. I think if you look at the church I was born into, and that's the correct term for that church, and what it held as sincerely held beliefs, they held them sincerely, but I also believe that those sincerely held beliefs in the gospel halls became a form of idolatry. That it got to a point where those churches failed to see the other and it could only see a legal outcome to every situation. And so for me, understanding that that was actually a kind of hypocrisy has only been a more recent phenomena for me, that their inability to see the very other they were trying to win for Christ is problematic. But also in my own particular story, and this has been a very recent revelation, is the sense to which that need to maintain a certain kind of public position meant that they swept all kinds of things under the carpet. And in my own personal journey, the church became very destructive for me as a person because of in my own family's story, how the church navigated difficult stories within my family. And so if I go back to my childhood, I'm beginning to understand more deeply the actual harm the church leaders caused my family and then myself as a result of that. So I'm having to wrestle with that at the same time. I think that story is particularly true of the gospel halls where I grew up. But as I've had an opportunity, and I would say it's a blessed opportunity to view the church not only in a North American context, but in a global context where I've traveled for work and seen in different places, I've started to see, I think, an emerging story that really concerns me, especially when we see church leadership defend certain kinds of people whose life and actions are antithetical to the faith in lots of ways. And I think that's become more recently a very bothersome element of it for me, I think the politicization of the church. And there are those who say it isn't in Canada. That's an American phenomenon. I simply don't agree. I've seen enough of it in the Canadian church to believe it's there. I think that's where my disaffectedness is starting to emerge more and more, is that I don't want to be associated with a name or an identity that in other sectors associates with a kind of political articulation that lacks grace, that lacks mercy, that lacks care for the other, that sees the solutions to their need for the culture to conform to their ideas as being legal solutions and those sorts of things. And yet at the same time, their leaders are having moral failures all over the place. And the incongruence of those things just has become weighty.
So I'm not interested in being salacious about this, but there are some of these stories that have reached the press, and just for context, which are the ones that have risen to the top for you that have really highlighted this incongruity?
I think it's a mix of there's some stories that are simply not salacious. I think it's seeing leaders of parachurch organizations and leaders of conventions of particular denominations throw their weight wholly behind single political entities or political persons, who then in turn are beholden in some way to them, and therefore the church is beholden as well. And I think that's very concerning to me. I don't think if I see Jesus in the few times he dealt with these kind of conversations, I don't see him suggesting that the gospel is somehow formed through political association. And I don't want to be associated with a gospel that is formed through political association on any side of a debate. And then at the same time, as you see these stories unfold, you see the so-called heroes or champions of the faith falling in what you might call moral failures. And you see the church struggling to defend them in certain kinds of spaces. And that's very bothersome to me. It's ugly. In one particular case, I read an article of a pastor that empathized with the perpetrator, not the victims. Where's the justice in that? And I'll be really clear. I don't live in a glass house. So if I'm going to throw a stone, I have to gaze into my own life here as well. But I think the story of the gospel where I'm overwhelmed is one of grace and mercy, which I don't see that being extended to victims or in the political sense to those with whom we disagree. And so I struggle to be associated with those movements now, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I'm trying not to be salacious as well. Mm-hmm. I'm bothered by it. You know, there's a particular case of a very prominent female theologian and speaker and preacher in a particular convention in the U.S. who had to leave the convention because she dared challenge the support that convention had for a particular politician. How can that lead to her excommunication from the convention? That seems impossible to me.
You know, the church's first calendar, when they were called the people of the way, before they really were even called Christian, mm-hmm. was a martyr's calendar. Mm. And as you well know, the first 300 years of the Christian communities, these small people of the way, they were frequently mm-hmm. Challenged by the state, by the emperor, and the imperial government. They were seen as potentially seditious. They were ministering to the poor, not their poor, but the poor of the empire, which really angered the emperor. Mm-hmm. And many were killed, and many were imprisoned, and many were exiled. So at the very heart of the first centuries, the first generations of Christians, at the very heart of their understanding of the gospel, isn't a political theology that claims something. If you can argue for any political theology in it at all, a large part of that would be simply a kind of prophetic critique of political power mm-hmm. and its dangers. And they knew that in their flesh. Mm-hmm. They knew that in their flesh. At the same time, very early in the history of the church, the liturgy that was developed, the various liturgies that developed, largely based on, all of them really are rooted in baptismal prayers that we first recognize in Jerusalem. Those prayers are prayers of not turning your back on the world, but not doing the world the way in which power and prestige does the world.
Yeah.
Understanding that the world is different than that.
Yeah.
That's a very particular appetite that's being transferred onto the world and tends to devour the world based on that. So these early prayers were turning your back on that way of understanding the world and coming to see the world in merciful terms.
Mm-hmm.
See the suffering of the world in merciful terms and seeking a disposition of compassion mm-hmm. in relationship to it.
Mm.
But as you well know, with the coming of Constantine and his bringing an end to the persecution of the church, we see a shift. Now, we can't blame bishops and presbyters in the fourth century for their sense of relief that they were no longer under the heel of the state and all of its power. They weren't under the heel of it anymore. It must have been an enormous relief. And in our day, we have a very existential, well, we've got a couple of them, touch points to that reality. In the Eastern Christian churches, the heel of the empire, the Soviet empire, the Bolsheviks, was felt vigorously.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes worse, sometimes a little lighter, until the wall came down. Many, many Orthodox, as well as other religious people, were imprisoned, thousands of them killed, bishops sucked into being a part of the Secret Service apparatus, and to indicate to the Secret Service which of their clergy or which of their parishioners in confession had mentioned something which would compromise them in the eyes of the state.
Mm-hmm.
It's a horrific story. So we should be able to understand more clearly what it was like when Constantine called an end to the persecution. And then he actually made the state, the church, an official institution of the state. And of course, he continued to support the Roman religion, which was ostensibly a religion in which you saw a deity being the kind of totem of an emperor. And so the worship of the deity and the emperor were synonymous with each mm-hmm. other. Constantine continued to do that till, I think, about 3 years before he died. He would build pagan temples and Christian temples mm-hmm. together. And we've seen the Soviet Union make use of something like the World Council of Churches as an instrument through which the clergy from the Russian church could speak words into the global conversation, mm-hmm. which the Soviet state found meaningful. And now, we have also an example in the way in which, the curious way, at least it seems curious to me, and you are so much closer and more knowledgeable than I am on this, the curious way in which the evangelical and fundamentalist Protestant churches in the United States and in Canada and elsewhere has really contrary, at least I think it's somewhat contrary to its own history, has become intimately entangled in party pre-politics, based largely on religious arguments about public policy, usually dressed up in the guise of some kind of moral purity.
Right. And I was a participant, David, in that activity. My years at some of the think tank world was not a veiled attempt. I think that's incorrect to say it that way. But it was an attempt to help bend public policy towards a particular position that was framed from a theological morality, if I can say it that way.
So this is when you were with the Center for Cultural Renewal on Parliament Hill.
And even with Cardas as well.
And with Cardas.
And I don't want to cast shade, to use a term my daughter would use, on either of those institutions, because I think they contributed meaningfully to the public debate. And so I want to very much say what I'm about to say, not in a frame of criticism, but in a frame of acknowledgement that there was a need, and it was often very much supported by wealthy people from the church who had as their agenda to see a particular public policy framed in a particular way towards their theological morality. And I think we did a lot of harm in that time. A lot of harm that's hard to undo, because we in those times didn't always take a moment to consider, as I've said earlier, the other. And we didn't take time, I think, to consider what the role of the church, and therefore a Christian who participates corporately in that space, ought to be. And I know different branches of the church think differently about this. I mean, for a Catholic, the disconnect between the polity and the church is almost never been there, as you've just articulated. From the legalization of the faith forward, it's been interesting. But from the evangelical wing, which was actually born out of the Reformation, which was born out of being the other, I think we've lost our history here a little. And now we've become the hammer. And that's a sadness for me now. And I think, you know, you ask what's the role of the church in any community? And the principal command of Scripture to the church is to care for widows and orphans. I don't see a command in Scripture that says, get involved in politics and make the society conform to some form of morality that you've set forward as the dominant morality. And I think, frankly, if I'm going to get really into this with you, the evangelicals' absolute fascination, darn near fetish, with sexuality is its Achilles heel. It will be its downfall. It is something that I don't understand how it got there. Because unlike something like abortion, for whichever side of the debate you were on, there was a principle of life and death involved in that. So I understand the position that the church took on that, whether for better or for worse. But some of the stuff on sexuality, I just don't understand. I think this is where it's lost its way. Maybe I've taken you off on a tangent you don't want to go
on.
Not at all.
I was just thinking a little bit about it. I recall in the 60s paying a lot of attention to the evangelical church. And because of the sort of youth movement, the movement for racial equality in the United States, where I was studying, the anti-Vietnam War movement, these three major movements were very significant in the 1960s. And you had various manifestations of bits and pieces of this movement. But one of the manifestations of it was that young people within some evangelical churches and universities, I think of Wheaton and Trinity University just outside of Chicago, one of the manifestations was for young people to become organizationally and politically involved and to realize that they had some voice and some ability to speak to these matters. So in a number of denominations, they went to the annual meetings. They got themselves elected, and no doubt their parents and grandparents, if they were cradle Baptists or in one of the various free churches, were delighted to see that their college student was interested in the church, not quite realizing what was up. And at the annual meetings, they countered the arguments which were being made about the Vietnam War and about issues of race. And in many cases, they even got the official body of the church to make declarative statements, which the majority of the older people actually weren't on side with. So there was a, I saw it, and I don't know how much you studied that period, but I saw it as a kind of crisis of identity within a range of evangelical churches at the time. At the same time, you had a couple strains developing, or at least it seems to me you had them developing. One of them was the beginnings of what we would now call the prosperity gospel. The kind of evangelicalism, and indeed some of the strains of fundamentalism that I'm familiar with from the prairies here that influenced my parents' generation, that was a the ethos of those movements, which entered many of the mainline churches as well, Lutherans of my parents' generation, for example. The ethos of it was informed by modesty, by never showing off your wealth if you had it.
Yeah, the right hand can't know what the left hand is doing.
Of course, yeah. Yes. Indeed, certainly in my family and a number of their friends, there was a pretty serious critique of businessmen and anybody who would get wealthy. It was seen as likely a moral failure of some sort. And then with the advent of the prosperity gospel, that gets turned on its head.
Of course. Yep.
So I remember being in a home where they had just bought a Cadillac. And these were evangelicals and fundamentalists. And I was terrible when I was 17, 18, 19, 20. Arrogant as noon. And I challenged this, given that they were very overt evangelical, quasi-fundamentalist Christians, and asked them, how come they bought a Cadillac? And the response was, God didn't make all the good things for the devil's children.
Oh, interesting.
And my response was, but a Cadillac isn't a good thing.
That's great.
Like why didn't you get a Volvo?
Well, Swedish for common sense. But it's interesting to...
Let me tease up one other vein here. So that was part of it, this element of the beginning of the shift around the Christian's relationship to the economy and to wealth. The second one was to sex. That is, there were several books that were published at the time in the evangelical world which were pushing it back against what had been the longstanding sort of moral purity of that wing of the church and the fact that there was very little discussion of the sexual life within that wing of the church. There was, as I recall, because I was amused by the title. There was a devotional book which was quite prominent in that wing of the church, which was titled Come Thee Apart.
Oh dear.
And it was it was often found on the bedside tables of evangelical Christians. And I never read it, but I often wondered what it was actually about. But this movement, which, of course, was also inspired. It was kind of the evangelical response to the sexual liberation movement of the time.
Yeah.
So you had the beginnings of, even in a movement like, what was the women's movement called? Real Women within the evangelical churches. You had the development of a new kind of sexual liberation. Now, it was a sexual liberation that was deeply confined, but it was an attempt to come to terms with pleasure.
Yeah.
And primarily pleasure and patriarchy, the way those were woven together. Mm-hmm. So I recall one book that was written, again, I never read it, but I had a student that wrote about this movement at one point. It was that women, wives, should realize in the evangelical world that their husbands are working hard and had a, you know, their days have always been difficult. So on occasion, they should actually meet their husband at the door when he comes home in a hyper-sexualized manner.
Right. Because that's what we all needed, right?
Well, that's apparently what men were understood to need, yes. Yeah. So...
what we really needed was a deep depth of intimacy that this movement actually took away from us.
No, that's interesting. So speak about that.
I think in the deepest sense, sexual intimacy is a form of communion. And
you're speaking like an Orthodox person again here.
I know it's
very dangerous.
But it is the ability to be known by another person.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no greater depth of being known by another person than in sexual intimacy. And to reduce...
well, intimacy.
Sexual
and otherwise, probably.
Yes, but sexual intimacy is the...
The most visceral.
The most visceral and a kind of fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
And to have a reductionist movement reduce that to some sort of... it's an immoral act that is somehow justified by the church in marriage. I actually want to call bullshit on that and say that actually destroyed our understanding of sexual intimacy. It ripped it from its core of that communion between two people and turned it into something we're supposed to feel guilty about or we're supposed to do out of duty to the other. And I so rebel against the morality that the church placed over sexuality in this period. And I think it was a fear, it was a reaction to the liberation movements that were taking place in the 1960s and 70s. I completely agree with that, but the harm it's done.
So this movement that I only know a little bit about in the evangelical and fundamentalist churches, which appeared to bring back pleasure, to say that Since God didn't make all the good things for the devil's children, this also included sexual relations.
Of course, yes.
Properly confined.
Properly confined.
Now, some of the critics of this have certainly suggested, and I think this might be implied in what you're saying as well, that part of this proper definition was still very much within the context of wives serving their husbands. I don't know if it's fair to say that, because I don't know enough about it. What I'm really wondering about is, I'm trying to get at, where does this, as you called it, fetishization of the sexual life and of issues of gender come from in that evangelical world? What's been the trajectory of that? What's been the kind of changes that have come about in that?
I think it's,
so there is a substantial change, I think, in the 60s, where a new kind of discourse develops around it, and there is a sense that this also is an area, and pleasure is not against God. Maybe the orgasm is, I don't know, but pleasure isn't against God as long as it's within the right kind of relationship. So if I'm right about that, that's a shift that occurs in the evangelical and Orthodox world. And it's not long after that shift takes place. I mean, the whole debate about abortion gets really takes off in the 60s as well. But also this issue of homosexuality, transgendered issues, what have you, that starts to become a public matter as well. Various groups of people begin to argue that they too need to have access to the state's licenses for marriage. All of that comes on the scene. So, I mean, I'm just thinking out loud here. If, in fact, that generation that made this shift in the evangelical world, informed by the prosperity gospel, informed by some sense that the sexual life wasn't just wrong or only for procreation, having discovered that, discovered these new pleasures, if you will, I wonder, is that in part, I mean, I've never really thought this through, is that in part what then became a heightened area of fear?
Of course. So you're
the gender issues and,
of course,
and sexual issues?
The very same thing that you talked about where the Cadillac story, where the gospel of prosperity or the prosperity gospel changes the dynamic from wealth being hidden because it conveyed a story to wealth being shown because it demonstrated God's blessing, if you will. In a kind of similar way, once the church had to come out and deal with sexual freedom becoming part of the story, I think they actually chose to take that which was private, make it public in a moral sense, in a moral outrage. I mean, Jerry Falwell, it's responsible for the beginning of the moral majority, which is a strange term, actually.
From a Christian perspective.
It's a strange term, even from a secular perspective. Because it's loaded. Both words are highly loaded with meaning. But that notion of we now have to address sexuality publicly and our position on it is going to be very, very strict. So as a boy who grew into a man in the late 80s and early 90s, the prime messaging from the churches that I was part of was that actually sexuality was this evil side of you that you had to discipline. Well, that doesn't carry over into marriage as have as much sex as you want and let's have it be great. Because you can't just bridge that divide by a 90-minute ceremony. That chasm for that generation that grew up on the messaging now that the church had to take a position on sexuality publicly, and it had to be one of morality. That translated in a kind of angst around sex for all of us. And my bet is, without any study into this, my bet is that the entire Gen X generation is completely dysfunctional with respect to its sexuality. The Christian Gen X group is completely dysfunctional when it comes to their sexuality, because we grew up on such a negative set of messaging, because it had to be public. The church had to have a position. And I think what's disaffected me now so greatly is how many times we watch these so-called leaders of the church fall on sexual grounds. You know, and we've seen them rail publicly against the very things they're guilty of, right? So
moral outrage is public confession.
Moral outrage is public confession. I think in psychological terms, we call that projection. Mm-hmm. I project that which I'm guilty of onto the other. Mm-hmm. And so I think that rather than allow those who are not part of the faith in our communities and in our cultures to go about their lives on their own terms, the only way we've dealt with our internal shit as the church is to project outwardly upon them, and we have lost our ability to recognize the other when it comes to sexual terms, sexual definition, right? And it's not about morality. And I know if anybody's listening right now, they're jumping out of their chair, and if they're Christian, saying, yes, it is, but it's actually not. It's not about morality. It is actually about a way of understanding yourself in relation to the rest of the world. And the evangelical wing of the church has lost its ability to do that.
You said that your generation in the evangelical church, I can't recall your exact words, but there's a dysfunction mm-hmm. around the body, mm-hmm. around the sexual life, mm-hmm. around intimacy.
Absolutely.
And you see this as a legacy of this religious tradition. So I want you to think more about that with me. Is part of it that, there's the long history of the evangelical and fundamentalist churches thinking about the church, about ecclesia, mm-hmm. as a moral fraternity.
Of course.
Of like-minded people. There's a long history of that. And some of that is one of the gifts of this tradition and gave them the impetus for doing some very good things. And some of it's much darker. But then what I described in the 60s with the shift, mm-hmm. really in your parents' generation, mm-hmm. I don't know how thorough that shift was, but it certainly was there for many. So then I assume as their children grow up, are they then put in this curious kind of bind where on the one hand they're getting the signals from the parents that the parents' generation actually sees mm-hmm. the sexual life as something that they, as a man and a woman married to each other, that pleasure is mm-hmm. is no longer just a bad pleasure mm-hmm. or some kind of need that they can find in some way. And then on the other side, this weighted language mm-hmm. around these matters being political mm-hmm. and then the new morality emerging sure. about them. And it's in fact a new kind of morality about them. And certainly its preoccupation yes. is new.
Yes.
Its centrality to the identity of evangelicals and fundamentalists sure. is new. evangelicals and fundamentalists have always been a little concerned about the sexual life. There's no question about that. But I'm trying to get at the shift that takes place and what happened.
It became a threat. Uh-huh. It became an existential threat in the 1960s. So, you know, a very cursory read of North American society prior to the 1960s would be a loose congruence between the evangelical church's morality and general morality in the culture. As you see what I would call the liberation movements beginning, feminism, sexual liberation, even substance liberation, if I can say that, that the stereotypes around the social mores, not the stereotype, the social mores around drug use, things like that began to come off. It actually became an existential threat to the church, the evangelical church, and they had to respond. And they responded with a kind of position that said, you know, Josh Mandel wrote a book called Right from Wrong and put it in black and white terms as to what was permitted and not permitted. But the messaging, and I'm going to use a word that I think is really important, especially for a male, the messaging led to emasculation of the sexual being. And I think this is what I'm now starting to understand in my own space, is that I grew up as a teenager in the 1980s and a young man in the early 1990s. And the church had fundamentally emasculated sex to the point where it now could make the argument against other forms of sexual identity as merely being about the act, right? So rather than embracing and understanding a gay man's identity, they reduced their critique to the act and simply reduced that person's identity to nothing more than copulation. Mm-hmm. And it was necessary for them to do that within the church first to be able to take the argument out into the public. And I see the damage that has done now to both those of us who grew up in the church and to those that were attacked by the church on the other side. I think the same is true of the role of women in the church and the struggle the evangelical church has had to embrace women in their fullness. I'm a father of daughters, so I think about this all the time, was because they had to respond to feminism. And in doing so, they had to create an internal structure to be able to go external. And that has been a very damaging space. To the point today where I think about the youth of today, unlike the youth that tried to take over the councils, the youth of today have just walked away and went, none of this makes any sense to me. In fact, most of the Christian, thoughtful Christian youth today are like, this is just bullshit, right? The Christian youth today want to reconcile a deep care they have for the other, and they want actually to look at their friends who are gay or lesbian or transgender, they want to be able to look at them and go, you know what? Love is love. I want you to have that space. I don't want to intrude upon that space for you. I want you to have it. But I have to reconcile that to this church position that I can't, that it's impossible to reconcile. And then they look at these failures of leaders like Falwell Jr. and Ravi Zacharias. Then they throw their arms in the air and they go, well, the so-called champions of the faith aren't even adhering to the sexual morality that they've laid out for us. I'd rather be aligned with those who talk about love as love than be aligned with the hypocrisy of the moral majority who turn around and are literally enslaving people to their sexual needs. And so I get why the church today is leaving in this space. We literally created the monster, if you will, that has now consumed the church. And I think the irony for me is that I realized how far we had gotten when the Christian church had to make excuse for misogynistic sexual statements by the political champion they were putting forward in the 2016 presidential election in the U.S. And the cognitive dissonance that it required to do that was sort of fun to watch, the dance that went on publicly on that one.
So describe it a little bit. What did you see?
I saw the church finally have a champion who was willing to do the things that they wanted with respect to transforming the polity towards Christian conservative ideals, towards that so-called moral majority. The irony is the very champion that was going to do that for them was himself a person who had been married three times, had cheated on every one of those wives, and made statements in public about his ability to just touch women wherever he wanted, wherever he wanted, things we would lock other people up for. And so I watched church leaders try to reconcile, we have the champion we want to get us to the promised land of Supreme Court justices and conservative politics, yet he's the antithesis of our moral majority.
He's an icon of the opposite.
He's an icon of the opposite. And watching them trip over themselves to make that cognitive dissonance work publicly was, for me, the end of respect for an entire group of people who lead the church, so-called public leaders of the church. I no longer could associate myself with the terminology because it was so fraught with hypocrisy by that time. The term evangelical, because it was so fraught with hypocrisy by that point. It was not an abandonment of what I believed. It was an abandonment of the identity chosen to describe what I believe. And I think if we look 5 years forward from 2016 till now, that cognitive dissonance in the church is now fully complete, because it's not only about sexuality anymore. It is literally will take on any form to get what we want. In political terms, we will ignore all things that might somehow not conform to our dogma. We just simply ignore them. Or worse, we actually champion people who would disavow them outright.
Where does this leave the evangelical and fundamentalist churches?
Soon to be irrelevant, I think. What I think, to not answering your question, but more describing the concern I have, is that I think there's an entire generation who will be homeless in terms of their ecclesia. Mm-hmm. They are orphans. Mm-hmm. I think there's a youth who want to be sincere believers, but have no community to join. Unless, of course, they all become Orthodox, of course.
So,
boy, I didn't even get a reaction to that.
God spare us. So if you're right, the generation of leadership of which you are one, and you have been one, leadership in various para-religious organizations, that this dissidence becomes intolerable, they leave. So I would assume that that would lead to a shrinking of these denominational bodies and of these organizations, but it would also lead to them being taken over by the people that really do drink the Kool-Aid around this.
Yes, I think that's true. That's what's going on. You read Bibby's work on church membership in his book Elasticity. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. You know, it's clear, especially in Canada, that the church is shrinking, the evangelical church is shrinking. And yet at the same time, it would appear strong. Right? And so there's this kind of facade that exists right now some of these mega, so what you know, the mega church movement, what the mega church movement is simply congregating smaller churches into one before they die.
So it's functioning like a Walmart.
It's functioning like a Walmart. I think eventually
it's sucking up the local vernaculars.
Yeah.
And it's sucking it up because the people who've realized and for whom this cognitive dissonance is intolerable are leaving.
Correct.
They're becoming homeless, as you called it.
Yeah.
And the ones that are left mm-hmm. are being sucked up by the new mega church Walmarts.
Right. And I live in the Fraser Valley where this is, you know, it wouldn't take me long to introduce you to 25 what I would call disaffected Christians my age, you know, and their families who 10 years ago were elders in the church. When they were 40, by the time they're 50, they're gone and out and their children with them. And I'm not so far off that journey myself, David. I don't see a lot left. And you know, the church that I am currently a member of, I will say, has never done anything to harm me. Or do I see it as having any sort of particular stake in this game that is greater or more unhealthy than any other? But I do see it being part of and having to associate with groups of people who are, I think, I'm going to use the word dangerous in the current cultural context we live in. A star burns brightest right before it burns out.
Yeah. Because you've also been involved in raising money for these parachurch organizations, you know, and our colleague Greg Pinoyer knows that the various family foundations that have funded churches and these parachurch organizations, they also, as I understand it from discussions with you and with Greg, are going through a leadership change.
Sure.
And this leadership change, how is it affected by these matters? Because it must be affected by them as well.
So there's a real so I'll answer that a couple of ways. There's a real pressure if you're a public institution of any sort, and anybody who's funding things as a form of a public institution, to be on the right side of public conversations, or some people like to say the right side of history. And so there's a growing discomfort amongst those who are taking over from their baby boomer and traditional generation parents,
these public money.
Who made the money, that they can no longer support organizations and entities that are on the wrong side of history. Whether that is a sincerely held belief on their part or just they know that they can't do this in the world of cancel culture and other things, that they're starting to shy away from funding the things their parents did. So I could give you an example, and I'm not going to name them because I respect all the people involved, but recently a very, very large Christian foundation in Canada, I describe it that way, although the donor behind it supported his community almost equal dollars to his support for Christian projects.
I mean, supported his
local community.
Local community.
Yeah. Public art, libraries, hospitals, etc. He recently died. He was somebody who was born in 1931. I attended his funeral just before COVID. I know his children who are my age who've taken over. And it didn't take a year even before they stopped funding the things that their father funded and began to turn their eyes towards other things. And we were one of the organizations that, you know, were the casualty of that. I saw it coming because what their father valued in terms of the evangelical church was not valued by them because they weren't actually members of it anymore. Whether in practice or in spirit, doesn't matter. Same outcome.
Has their political vision changed?
Very much. I would say, not just speaking about that family in particular, but knowing that they would not subscribe to the political views of the conservative evangelical church. Lots of this next generation won't and don't and won't support things that are particularly problematic for them. And this will be the death of some parachurch organizations. Now, I think they will have a lease on life because some of these aging donors who care about things that are very out of vogue anymore will leave large legacies to them in their will. So I don't anticipate the end of these parachurch organizations to be imminent, but they will have to reform at some point or die for sure. And as for, you know, one of the themes we didn't pick up from earlier, if I can just jump back, is the whole gospel, the prosperity gospel, which I think most people in the evangelical church in North America would object to you terming that way. They see that as a problem of other spaces, not their space. But the rise of the parachurch philanthropic organization that purported to go out into the world and solve all kinds of problems in the name of Jesus required wealthy Christians, wealthy philanthropists to support them. So it actually required a public display of wealth in order for these parachurch organizations to survive. I mean, we all know that it was at least an 80-20 principle in every organization, meaning 80% of the funding of that organization came from 20% of its donors. Now, truthfully, that's generous. In most organizations, it would probably be more akin to something like 90-20.
90-10,
sorry, yes. Where 90% of the funding was coming from 10%. And these wealthy donors who I've spent a lot of time with had a range of motivations for their giving. I would describe them all as sincere, but all as different from a theological formation of their generosity. Some view it as duty. Some view it as great as generosity in a graceful and merciful sense. Others viewed it as a way of displaying their wealth, and still others displayed it as a way of promoting their business.
And others, I've noticed, do it also because they do not believe in governmental institutions.
Of course.
And it's a good tax write-off. And you get to determine where your money goes instead of the government determining where it goes.
And all of those are sincere. And so I don't wish to present them in a way where I'm critical of them.
Right. Yeah.
What I do when I write my book, Confessions of a Fundraiser, what I will have to deal with somewhere in my deep sense of my own comfort with myself is that did I change the story at any point to appeal to one of those motivations that we just discussed? Right? Did I hesitate to use the word, prostitute myself to the aspirations of the person giving?
You've been very good at this, right? I can't imagine that you didn't have very good instincts about how you shaped the discourse with these people.
Of course, and I actually have a lot of guilt about that. Not to say that the giving that they gave didn't go to good causes. That's actually not the point. It's the process by which we engaged donors from within the Christian frame around wealth that there lies the problem. And I know so many so-called philanthropists and donors who have been so hurt by the church and parachurch organizations that saw them as ATMs. So on the other side of this coin is a kind of Robin Hood mentality that said, well, we need to actually relieve the wealthy of their wealth so that they can be better Christians. And I have no doubt that that statement would offend some, but I guarantee you it's true.
So this leads to a third element in that I wanted to think with you about. Along with your deepening sense of the shift that's gone on within the evangelical and fundamentalist churches. You've also been undergoing a change in your thinking about initiatives coming through these para religious organizations around the meaning of charity. That is, what the charitable model, where that has led us, how the charitable model, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I wonder if you have not really been coming to a point where you see the charitable model as also part of a colonial model, and that you also have been wondering about whether that model has actually been fruitful for the people it claims to be fruitful for, or whether it's in fact contributed to dysfunction, or at least lack of opportunity.
Yeah,
Walk into that.
There's so many entry points to that. So the rise of what I will call mass charity, both Christian and otherwise, is a relatively recent phenomena. Ironically or not, probably not, associated with some of the same timelines we've just been discussing. So the Ethiopian famine in the 80s is the first time we watched a famine on national television at 6 o'clock. So we sat, you know, ostensibly in our living rooms with our TV dinners on our laps, or around the kitchen table with a TV in the corner, and we watched the famine in Ethiopia unfold in relativeness to our wealth and our abundance. And it produced a guilt. That wasn't just a Christian thing. You know, you can think of Live Aid, you can think of all this, which, you know, from the irony of that was not the first famine in Ethiopia or any other place it had. It was just the first one to gain mass media awareness. And it thrust into vogue the notion of doing charitable work outside of our local community. Because charity before that had been largely centered locally, and for the Christian was largely an extension of the church to community. So it was actually us doing what the church was supposed to be in the community.
Engaging the other.
Engaging the other. Now, that's, of course, we know that the Catholic Church for ages has had missions around the world and all that, so I don't want to reduce the argument completely. But this was the first time the kind of mass movement towards the Christian church getting involved in what I might call international aid began to take place and began to get set up. And a lot of those structures were designed as extra church structures, or what we would call parachurch structures. Sometimes they were the wing and arms of denominations. Sometimes they were set up independent of that. The social entrepreneur developed. I think in the early years, those organizations did a lot of good. But like so many things we get into as human beings, we don't actually think about the end game. How do we get out of what we're doing? And they became self-perpetuating. And then they became destructive. So for example, I could use the Haiti earthquake as an example. The aid that arrived immediately after the Haitian earthquake in, I believe, 2010, was very necessary. In fact, was it earlier than 2010? I think what year that was. But what most people forget is that Haiti, before that particular earthquake that destroyed so much, was actually a rice exporting nation. Today, 100% of the rice consumed in Haiti is imported. That is a legacy of damage that's left behind by the aid movement, many of whom are Christian organizations still set up in Haiti today, years later, as opposed to having an end game. The same is true around the world of where aid takes place. And what we tell ourselves every day when we wake up, and I've done this, I've been in this world for a long time, we tell ourselves that the need is so great that we should just keep going. But we don't pause to ask the really, I think, important question is, would the need be so great if we weren't there, which is a kind of existential problem that no organization wants to ask itself because it has legions of people working on this side of the world who need their jobs to be justified on a daily basis. My disconnect from it, with it, becomes there as a starting point. I've also, David, had the incredible privilege of spending a lot of my time in sub-Saharan Africa and becoming very close and good friends with people who, after some time, began to see me as a peer and someone they could talk to, not as somebody they had to defer to, which was something that bothered me. And in that trust of relationship that took place over years, I began to have conversations about their assessment of their own countries and their own need spaces. And in no case was charity the solution. They could see it clear as day, yet they were part of the apparatus in so many ways as well. But
it gave them a check.
It gave them a check. You know, I think of one particular individual in Ethiopia that I know well, who the organization he leads is literally every mission statement, every Ethiopian child educated without foreign aid by 2030. He's a USC educated doctor of education, went back to Ethiopia. That's his vision. He sees the problem clearly, right? And so for me, I want to be part of a solution that is not about the Western charity, but about the African opportunity, which I can't define. The African has to define that opportunity. What I can do is do for them what somebody did for me, which was provide the venture capital that allowed me to become a person of modest wealth that I am today. For us in North America, that was a bank and a mortgage and property values. For the Ethiopian, that will be venture capital for the dozens and dozens of ideas that young African entrepreneurs have that they want to get started. But, you know, 500 million people in sub-Saharan Africa are unbanked. So where do they go?
Right.
And so how do we become part of providing that? And I think there's an entire subset. You talked about that next generation of donors who are taking over from their parents. This appeals to them very greatly because it's not actually a charitable gift. It's not actually aid.
So the charitable organizations, is it fair to say, well, you can put this so much better than I, but let me give you that chance. I often think of charity, you well know, that charity and social justice mm-hmm. have often aligned themselves with particular constituencies of the church.
Yep.
So the conservative evangelical church does charity, and the liberal churches work for social justice.
Sure.
This is the common way in which these things have been teased up. My father was unusual in this regard in that he certainly believed in charity. I don't think anybody ever asked him for a dime that he didn't tell that person his name and ask their name and offer to buy them lunch. And at the same time, he had a very strong sense from his childhood in Norway that charity is a rich man's game.
Mm-hmm.
Charity does something for the rich man. I remember, I believe it was St. John Chrysostom, who said, when the beggar outside the church, this is here the great Church of Holy Wisdom in Constantinople, when those clinging to the porch that you are going to pass by at the end of our liturgy, when they ask you for bread so they can live till tomorrow, you are giving them nothing
mm-hmm.
compared to what they are giving you. They are giving you their dignity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you are giving them a little bit of bread, maybe.
Yeah, that's so true.
So in my father's case, he told me about Christian Bjelland, who was the who owned the large, huge fish factory mm-hmm. on the port in Stavanger, and how Christian Bjelland, after Easter, mm-hmm. after the resurrection, would have a procession every mm-hmm. year mm-hmm. to the Domkirk. Mm-hmm. You know, it was what, my memory, maybe 200 steps mm-hmm. from up the church was on a little elevation. He would process up there, and the bishop would come out and meet him, and there would be fanfare.
Mm-hmm. Spectacle.
Spectacle. Mm-hmm. And he would give his charitable donation.
Of course.
Now, that charitable donation was used for the poor in Stavanger, mm-hmm. so it had a local dimension to it. But in my father's time, and my father was born in 09, so this would have occurred sometime between 09 and 1928. I don't recall the date. The fishermen got together and they spoke to the bishop and they said, Christian Bjelland is going to come processing up here to give you his charitable donation. So us fishermen who are working very hard in difficult circumstances can live till tomorrow because he does not pay us enough for today.
Of course, yes.
Of course. If you take this charitable donation this year, mm-hmm. we are going to prevent him from coming and giving it to you. Mm-hmm. You must speak a word to this man. Mm-hmm. So there was a protest. This yeah. imprinted itself on my
of course.
on my father's mind. So he always had a somewhat different way of holding together mm-hmm. charity and issues of proper wages and proper circumstances
of course.
For
of course.
People. So my way of thinking about this is the need for triage. Mm. You know, within our society, there are accidents that happen. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're fiscal. There are accidents that happen, and we need to have triage. When a hurricane comes through New Orleans, you know, it's admirable that the first people on the scene are evangelicals and fundamentalists. They do the triage.
Of course.
But when your whole social imaginary mm-hmm. becomes fixated on triage, i.e. on charity, mm-hmm. and there's no room for healthcare. Mm-hmm. That is, for what constitutes healthy mm-hmm. ways
yeah.
of making it possible for people to mature within their social world mm-hmm. and to no longer need charity. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that that mix has been so poorly configured.
For sure.
I mean, I think it's been poorly configured on both sides. My sense is that often on the liberal side of this, there's a complete rejection of charity.
Of course.
Because they see it as perpetuating a problem. But my sense is that both are necessary. But what you seem to be describing here is that with the development of mass charitable organizations, really since the 60s or so, within the evangelical and fundamentalist world, that there's another shift taking place here, which is the recognition that the charity model, as necessary as it may be, is really needs to be understood as triage model.
Yeah.
And the healthcare model, that is, what does it take to see that various communities receiving aid mm-hmm. from the so-called developed world, that they stop this way, I would characterize it as infantilizing the poor.
Yeah, totally. Can I enter to answer into the conversation of this? The first principle for me that governs my thinking on this is generosity or a charitable gift can never be absolution.
Ah, absolution for the person who's giving it.
Correct.
And that's the way you are suggesting it's been understood.
For some.
The charity model has often been, has had something to do with the person giving it feeling better about themselves.
Absolving themselves from this responsibility or this guilt they have around being wealthy within the church. In fact, I would say for some, it's if you're wealthy in the church today, you must give to earn your absolution, to earn your acceptance. And I think that's wrong because that actually doesn't consider the person. It only considers their wallet. Let me come at it from a different angle as well. I think that what I've seen is there's a distinction that is not understood between charity and philanthropy. They actually mean different things. And so if I could be so bold as I think there's a very rightful place of charity within the Christian walk and perhaps even within the Christian disciplines. And the correlating principle, the correlating discipline for charity is also generosity. Charity requires generosity. Generosity ought not to be a public thing. So you and I bought a couple lunch today. They will never be able to find us and thank us, and I don't care because it's not about that. It was about the impulse of generosity in the moment to say, I want to give something to you. That impulse is deeply spiritual and it's right. What philanthropy has done to that impulse is to turn it into a system. It's systematized it, it's institutionalized it, it's given structure to it, how we ask for it. It's created a whole job category called fundraisers or development officers, you know, or advanced. I mean, if you think about all of this, you think, this is crazy. We have reduced these very proper spiritual acts of humanness, which are generosity and charity. We've turned them into something that they're not. And there's a sorrow for me. And that sorrow extends to the donors who give, who feel these. So I wish to share a story of a very, very, very close friend of mine who's very wealthy. Who once when we were talking about a person that we both know who headed up a charity, he said to me, he says, you know, this person and his wife, they're coming up to stay with me for the weekend. And then the next words out of his mouth broke me. My friend said, I wish I knew if we were truly friends. And I pressed into that. I said, what do you mean by that? And he goes, as long as he asks me to give to his organization, I will never know whether we are truly friends. And I would imagine having to go through life like that, like David, that in every relationship you exist in, you wonder about the authenticity of it because of its structure of the relationship. That's where we've gone wrong. And so for me, I don't wish to see the end of charity. I wish to see charity restored to its rightful place within the Christian discipline, within the ecclesia, within the church, within the relationships between people. I don't believe that until we dismantle the Christian international aid infrastructure, the industrial complexes, Eisenhower would call other things, that we will actually be able to restore those relationships. That's not to say there isn't a need to respond around the world in the context of charity, triage, as you say. I even think, in a careful way, the church supporting the church around the world, certain kinds of activities that'll never be profitable, so to speak, like healthcare. But at the same time, do we simply just let nations off the hook, national governments off the hook by providing the very things that they should be? Do we allow archaic tax systems to persevere in countries where we got rid of them in Western society because we knew we had to provide? Like all these things become questions. And so for me, it's about a right sizing of charity. And it's about acknowledging that giving somebody something can be very harmful. We can't just back up trucks of stuff to African villages and unload it and think that we're not doing harm. Or trucks of money, for that matter. What we can do is we can partner with those communities to say, what would it look like for you to have your dignity in this relationship with us? What's necessary for you to feel like you're our peer? Because the essence of colonialism is the imbalance of power. And we use ridiculous words in the charitable sector. We talk about, let's go out there and empower women. And I hear men saying, let's empower women. I think to myself, huh, how, if not by a power dynamic, can that take place? How can we empower an African if not through a power dynamic? Because the very word empower connotates an imbalance of power. And so I think asking about dignity is a very important piece. And when you get very close to people for whom you work with in the charitable space, you realize that their subservience to you assaults their dignity. And I can't do that anymore. I can't be part of that anymore. It bothers me to my core. And, you know, it's little things like getting off a plane and being met by, you know, the country director of the organization you lead, who he himself runs a $3.5 million enterprise in that country, and he feels the need to take your bag from you and carry it. And then you walk, you parade in front of all of the people of his country watching him carry the bag for the white man that just got off the plane. We can't do that anymore. That's an assault on their dignity. And so for me, that's the shift that's taken place over the last little while. I am deeply burdened by the poverty I still see. Don't get me wrong. I am deeply burdened by the injustices I still see. But I think there's another way to get there. Still being part of the solution without it being an imbalance of power. Sorry, that was very long-winded.
Not at all. So we have talked primarily about, I guess, what I would call some of the diseases within this wing of the church, the evangelical and fundamentalist wing of the church, a wing of the church that I have a lot of regard for, and I know you do too. And it's probably because we have that regard and we know something about it historically that we care enough and have struggled to see what has happened and these diseases. Have you ever tried to think of what the ecclesia is, what the church is, in ways that rise above, so that the ecclesia is not seen through this prism? Have you ever tried to imagine that? I mean, you hinted at it when you talked a little bit just a few moments ago about what I see as the spiritual knot, how it comes about that people who have wealth and who are part of this charitable industrial complex.
We should coin that phrase. It's a good phrase.
That their relationships are reshaped as ones where friendship is no longer something they can have confidence in because they see themselves as probably being used, or they don't have trust in those relationships anymore. The relationship itself has been framed by this set of procedures and circumstances and institutions. Have you ever tried to think of?
So, I mean, I think I can answer that in what I long for.
That's yeah, I'd like to hear that.
Which is maybe isn't as precise an answer to the question.
Great. No, that's great.
I long for the church under whatever denominational banner you place it to live in that simplicity of just a few things. Community. I think the church a long time ago forgot that it actually was about knowing what it meant to use the word and the name Jesus. I think...
What did that mean?
So the evangelical church doesn't have the liturgy that some of the other wings of the church has to remind themselves on a weekly or even daily basis of what roots you to your identity as a Christian. And what roots you to your identity as a Christian is what your understanding of Jesus is. And the evangelical wing of the church at its root understands Jesus to be the savior of souls. Its entire missiology is grounded in that idea, but they've forgotten what that means. It's not a savior of souls from the perspective of let's count a check mark and a conversion, but it's about Jesus being that transformer of a life in the essence of working out of your faith on a daily basis. The church no longer presents a place where you can go to work out your faith in community with other broken people who also don't have their shit together and don't need to portray that they have their shit together. The church is no longer a place you can show up in your brokenness. So it's not a hospital anymore. It is the worst of a social media gathering where we all put on our very best look and pretend that it's all okay while listening to a garage plan band play a few songs and a hip preacher with a tattoo giving us a feel-good message. And you go home from that feeling really, really empty. But the church, the longing I have is for that place where I can show up and be completely authentic. And I've thought a lot about the description of the early church where the master, so to the conversation we were having, where the master and the slave could sit down together around communion. In the context of wealth, those who have wealth and those who don't in the modern age. And I wish for a study on that to try to understand a little bit more about how that worked in the early church. Because I think there's an instruction there for us. Because some of what I bring in my brokenness to my relationships, my own struggle with money, my own jealousies, my own insecurities, right? I confess those in my relationship with donors. I often tell them out of the gate, look, this is who I am, right? Before I ever get into a relationship with you where I ask you to support a cause I'm involved in, I need to confess to you I struggle, which often leads to really interesting conversations with donors. That's an aside. I long for the church to be that place. And I'm simply not going to go anymore to a place that is trite. Because I can't do the false exercise of church, if you will. So my longing is around real community, around remembrance. And by remembrance, I mean not giving lip service to Jesus, but actually taking time to make that active in the present, which I think is what the liturgy does for those who are of the Eastern Church. And then when it comes to the mission of the church, there was an incredible simplicity in taking care of widows and orphans. It doesn't mean actually taking care of widows and orphans. It meant a lot more than that. It was that sense to which you are responsible as the church for the totality of brokenness in the place where you exist, which means you have to have a deep, deep regard for the other. Because widows and orphans might be quite bothersome to you some days as a human being. But that's exactly why you have to be there to take care as the church and not farm that out to other institutions, but to live in the mess of that.
What it really meant is that if it's lived properly, there are no widows and orphans.
Exactly right.
Because we are each other's companions. We stand with each other.
And orphans means, it also might mean that we're all widows and orphans.
Yeah, right.
Like we all are orphaned to certain kinds of things.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that there's a place like that. Maybe it's very idealistic, David, but this performance that most churches call church now, I don't have space to engage in that anymore because there's an emptiness that follows that for me. And that emptiness turns to bitterness very quickly. And I think that maybe what we need is another movement like the Desert Fathers and the Desert Mothers, who saw themselves as a repudiation of the institutions that were forming. And I'm not an idealist in the sense that I believe that we could actually create that, but the spirit of that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that wouldn't bring a certain group, part of that youth movement who still want to believe in something back. So what the evangelical church lost, and you and I have had this conversation, we haven't talked about it today, but somewhere along the way, the evangelical church lost the discipline of confession. There is no mechanism within a Protestant evangelical church to be confessional. And I think they even reject in principle the Catholic notion of this because they reject the notion that a priest can absolve you of your sin. And so they've created a space even which pastors cannot receive you in a confessional space.
But it's interesting how you've spoken about absolving yourself
mm-hmm.
through charitable work.
Of course, because we need absolution.
Yeah.
And even if we understand theologically that we're absolved already,
we
still need the practice of absolution because we are simple human beings who need to be told that we're okay every day.
I am struck by how your description reflects in evangelical and fundamentalist churches the migration of indulgences from the medieval world.
Mm-hmm.
Into
of course,
an institution of indulgence.
It's a really good
metaphor.
That has
been created by
a really
the
good metaphor.
Industrial complex.
Truly. And I don't think that's true of every single person who gives. I want to be clear on that. But I think if you asked...
Nor was it in the Middle Ages.
No.
Yeah.
But I think if you asked some people who are very generous with their money to really dive deep into their soul and examine what goes on for them at a transactional level when that takes place, something akin to absolution would rise to the surface.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. I grew up in an evangelical church and continue to hold its gifts fondly. I know Ray also holds this wing of the Christian faith with affection. That is perhaps why, observing what has unfolded and being part of it, has become a source of grief and deep concern. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.